Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're going to take you on a little tour of the beverages, libations, drinks, starting with, first thing in the morning, coffee.
There we go.
We have a real honest-to-God inventor, Bruce Burroughs, who has devised a great length to develop a new system of steaming coffee grounds.
It has more features than all get out.
Yes, and it also
makes wonderful coffee.
It makes wonderful coffee. It also has a little cheery tune to start and finish in the morning. Let's listen to Bruce. Bruce Burroughs is an honest-to-God inventor. I envy you that talent, Bruce.
It's a lot of fun, and I'll have to say it is a lot of work.
Well, I really approached your major invention with a great deal of skepticism. It's called iCoffee Brewer System. And I have tried so many, many types of coffee brewing. I have air brewing and drip and perk and electric this and, you know, all these things. And I've never been able to get rid of the acidic, whatever, byproduct, whatever it is in coffee that used to turn my stomach in the morning. So I was not really anticipating much success with your new machine until I tried it, and I was blown away. What you say about it is true.
Go ahead, let him say what he says about it.
What do you say about it?
Well, Ann, like you and every other coffee lover in the world, I bought endless amount of machines. I mean, every year there's a new model, and we keep thinking, okay, this is the one. This is going to eliminate the bitterness. This is going to eliminate the bitter aftertaste that you get with coffee.
Right.
And it just never did. So I said, okay, coffee brewers have not changed since Joe DiMaggio came on TV and said, hi, I'm Joe DiMaggio for Mr. Coffee, best cup of coffee you've ever had. Mr. Coffee brewer patents ran out. That's what everybody has. So I said, there's got to be a better way. Because, you know, life is too short, and to drink a bitter cup of coffee with that aftertaste. So I set out to work to find the perfect way. And what I found was, for those of you out there, coffee lovers, that have had French press coffee with a French press, you know it's smooth. There's no bitterness, and there's no aftertaste. Well, French press takes a long time, 4 minutes to make a cup. There's a lot of cleanup, but to a lot of coffee lovers, that kind of cleanup and length of time was worth it. So I said, how do we make an automatic coffee brewer that gave you that smooth, non-bitter, got rid of the acid, acidic, bitter aftertaste? And that's how iCoffee was born.
So that's what gave you the idea, the French press. Have you ever tried the AeroPress, which actually works pretty well, too, except that it's awkward to use?
Well, and that was the complaints I was getting, was the way to get a perfect cup of coffee is very awkward to use. People pour it over on a Chemex.
Yeah, you know, we did that,
the
too.
Aficionados do that. And that's fine, but there had to be a better way. And when you take coffee grounds and you first steam them and you get them wet with steam, steam thermally shocks them, and then you start to stir them. Like when you pour water into a French press, all the grounds become waterborne. They don't compact. And when you stir them around, we have six coffee jets. Imagine six coffee jets whirling around the coffee. You steam it and then stir it, and that cracks open the grounds. When you crack open the grounds, you get to the inside, and that releases all of the hidden flavors that other brewers leave behind. And you keep stirring. When you look at our coffee being brewed, you can see it visually.
Yeah.
In a brewing window, you see that rich coffee crema brewing and forming on top of the coffee, and you know that the most smoothest, richest, non-bitter tasting coffee.
You have a couple of choices in the coffee making department. One of the things I noticed, we make eight cups in the morning, and the eighth one I drink after lunch. warmed over in the microwave, and it still tastes good. It's absolutely amazing. But when you clean up the cup, you notice there's a sort of a slurry, a sort of a scum separate from the grains.
What you're describing is a richly, finely extracted coffee essence.
Right.
Whenever you crack open grounds, you're going to have fine essence that goes to the bottom. That's what creates all that flavor. But what you're describing is you can take coffee brewed by the jet steam brewing method, our method, iCoffee's method, and you can let it sit for several hours and then reheat it. It's not bitter because you drove out the bitterness when you brewed it.
I got it. Now, what do you do? Do you use that final filter, or do you not use it?
I personally do not use the optional sediment filter.
Yeah, great.
Here's why I developed it. You've got to give credit. You have to acknowledge that there are millions of coffee lovers who've been using paper filters their whole lives, and because that's the way Mr. Coffee started out, with paper filters, and they have to buy paper filter after paper. It never ends. The paper filters screen out the richly extracted coffee essence. Our steam brewing method, it doesn't. So if you want closer to the paper filter experience, you will use our included, no charge for our optional filter, which snaps into the craft and gives you that paper filter experience. No. You can have it both ways.
Yep. Yeah, I noticed that. I tried it both ways. And we're running now with unfiltered.
Yeah.
And you can certainly see the effect of the unfiltered in the cup, but it washes away just fine, and it doesn't interfere with the taste one slightest little bit.
I have a question. As you had the concept to start with, why did it take you 7 years and over 1,257 prototypes to get to the point where you're selling this?
And you would think I've been asked this question before. I haven't. Not in this direct way. It's really simple. I would get to the point where I would think it'd be ready to go to market. And then my wife said, are there BPAs? Those nasty chemicals that leach out of bottled water plastics, are there BPAs in your brewer? And I'd say, well, yeah, most brewers have it. A lot of brewers have it. Some brewers have it. She'd say, that's not acceptable. That hurts women and children. So there goes a year.
Oh,
a year to get the BPAs out. And then what happens? I have friends that need to rush to the airport at 4:30 in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning. They want the coffee ready. You know, they program it. The coffee brews, it's ready as they're getting ready to walk out the door to go to the airport, put in their travel mug, and sure enough, they or their wife forgot to put the water in the brewer at night before they retired for the evening.
Oh, dear.
So that took another 6 months to put a sensor. If you don't add the water, it says add water. If you try to, and it won't let you set the programming feature.
Yeah, I've done that, and it does indeed do exactly that.
Also, you didn't put the lid on the coffee filter
inside
thing.
One. I made every mistake in the book because you're allowed to make mistakes.
Then what happened? Some other friends, they left their lid in their dishwasher, and I don't know why they couldn't find it, but they couldn't find it right away, so they just went crazy because without the lid, you know, the steam escaped. So we had to put a lid sensor in there.
Did your wife? Go ahead.
And so then people want to see their coffee being brewed. They want to see that rich coffee crema forming on top of the coffee. They want to see the coffee spinning around that window, that brew window that's on every guy coffee brewer.
See, I don't do
plastic,
that.
Oh, if that plastic, if you drop it, if it's not the highest, most expensive material in the world, it'll crack.
Mm.
And I don't care how many times you drop that, it is not going to crack. If you put it in the dishwasher, the heat doesn't bother it. It's the most expensive plastic I could buy. Hope that answers your question.
Yeah, well, did your wife choose the music?
That was me, because if you'll remember, many, many years ago, I'm gonna tell you a tune. I'm going to play a tune. And it was bum 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 bum. That was Maxwell House. And millions of people all over the world would hear that every day on the radio, on TV. Bum 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 bum. And that was Maxwell House, Good to the Last Drop. And it was a percolator, and they could see the coffee hitting the glass knob on the top. And, you know, I love Mozart. I thought, you press the button, it's like Pavlov's dog. You start to realize that rich, creamy, smooth, non-acidic, non-bitter coffee's coming.
I wish it would play for longer.
Me too. We're on the same page. And at the end, you hear it again.
Yes.
And you rush for the coffee brewer, and if you get there before your wife, you look at her and say, make your own.
Is that what you do?
Well, I really think this is wonderful. We've used it now, every day for about 3 weeks, is it?
Oh, it's been longer than that. We started using it as soon as we got it.
Yeah. And so it does have like an extra, after it finishes and you pour your coffee, it has more percolating going on. What is that?
There's a sort of like a little gurgle.
That's
because of a few drops of water drop down into the heater, and it evaporates. All coffee brewers have a little water left over in the lines.
Okay.
Our heater comes back on to purge that excess water out. You hear little gurgles.
Yeah, that's what it is.
You hear little gurgles, little noises. It kind of sounds like an old percolator, doesn't it?
It does. And I was just wondering, this doesn't mean that anything's going wrong with the maker.
Oh, no.
I mean, how long have you tested it for? How long will these last? Because the other thing, like with the Krupp's coffee maker, I mean, you count on X number of months, and the next thing it was emptying out all over your counter.
All I know is, can you imagine how mad all the iCoffee lovers that are now have to have their smooth coffee they've never had before in their life, and then all of a sudden all the machines start breaking down in a year?
No.
Not going to happen, right?
I'd have to leave the country.
You would.
That's what took 7 years.
I want to finish with a testimonial to the coffee maker, first of all, and then you need to tell us about what's coming down the road next.
And we want to know how to get this machine.
Because that's pretty exciting development. But the last 2 days, I took to having a cup of coffee after lunch, after years of not doing that, and I used to buy pre-ground, and I guess I'm not all that fussy about it. And there's a brand from Seattle called Gevalia,
which
Anne absolutely hates. What she doesn't know is that for the last 2 mornings, she's been drinking Gevalia pre-ground coffee, and she can't tell the difference.
You sneak.
I didn't want to leave it there because now I have a cup of coffee left over, so I don't need to make some at lunchtime.
Uh-huh.
So this bag is sitting there unused, and you know, if I left it there for 6 months, it would be unusable because it would be stale. So I decided I would use it, and then it turned into a great experiment. Can the Remington iCoffee maker deal with indifferent ground coffee? And the answer
is
yes. The answer is yes.
So it's not
any
even
coffee.
It doesn't even matter what kind of beans you buy or anything.
Doesn't matter.
Well, it probably does. I mean, I'm sure
any ground coffee.
I'm sure Pete's is probably better.
Any ground coffee, it iCoffee by Remington makes it better.
Now, what's next?
Well, do we find out how people get?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, we'll do that.
We should mention, by the way, that it's been featured big time on Consumer Reports. Positively.
Oh yeah, we were blessed with the cover of the Hot List Hot Pick for 2014. We're in major retailers: Bed Bath and Beyond, Dillard's, Sur La Table. We've appeared on HSN. We're about ready to appear again on HSN. We're in Frontgate, Chef's Catalog,
okay,
Wayfair, Amazon, multiple websites.
Okay, but on your website, is there a store location finder?
There is.
Okay, and so what is your website?
iCoffee.com.
Okay.
iCoffee.com.
And it retails for what, $169?
$169.95.
Okay. That's worth every penny of it.
But coming next is a new departure, I guess you're getting with a new departure in coffee making, which is an easy way to make one cup. So go ahead and tell us about when that's going to be available, available.
That's going to be, if we can't make a one cup that tastes as good as the iCoffee, we won't do it. That's the goal. We've got all of our people, best people on it, and we care about coffee lovers, and we surely could. Coffee is such a positive addition to your life. We take this very seriously. That's why the iCoffee brewer, we spared no expense in the materials. That's why it's built to last. And every appliance that we put our attention on and put our people on and eventually go to market with will be full of new technology, a vast improvement over all the other technology or commodity status products that are all out there. And again, the quality, it's all about the quality, because people eventually figure out if you're trying to make something cheap and they don't appreciate it. So we like to think that we're following the Apple model. Do it right, do it well, be proud, engineer in the quality, and give the customer true value so that they come back and they believe in you.
Well, it's a marvelous story.
It is a great story.
And as Anne said at the beginning of a conversation with you, she was extraordinarily
skeptical,
whatever, skeptical. Whatever you call it. And I didn't record what she said.
you both are iCoffee users. You're coffee lovers, iCoffee users. You're now in the iCoffee by Remington Company
Total Converts.
Family.
Yep.
You're converts, and anything I can do for you, let me know. I'm here for you guys.
Yeah, and let us know when you come up with new products. I mean, they're not all going to be about coffee, are they?
You're in my list. You're okay. On my list. Everything that's new, I'm sending to you first, because, as you know, two things as a manufacturer. You have to be extremely brutally honest with the technology. You cannot be in denial. You have to be perfect or the customers will figure it out. So I'd be proud to send you everything we come up with new, because I know that if there's something wrong, you're going to find it, and I appreciate that. And I want to thank you very much for this interview.
Okay, Bruce. Thank you for joining us today. And we'll look forward to talking to you in the future about something else that's new and revolutionary and wonderful and all of the things you said. So thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
One of the really fascinating features of the iCoffee is that it plays a little tune, one bar of Eine Kleine Nachtmusik, and we thought we'd broken it the other day, but it turned out that we hadn't. We just had pushed the wrong button, so when we pushed the button that had the music sign on it, it came back again. What a relief that is, huh? Pop, pop, fizz, fizz, oh, what a relief that is.
Well, actually, it's more based on Maxwell House coffee.
There we go.
Good to the very last drop.
And anyway, we'll be right back with more beverage stuff right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're going to be moving from coffee to grape juice, as in vino. And we're going to be talking to Paul Kalemkiarian.
Oh, aren't you clever?
Yes, I am.
For pronouncing that. I didn't even try.
Yeah, well, anyhow, who now runs the very first, well, it's his father's who founded this company, the very first Wine of the Month Club. And why not? I mean, there's Book of the Month, there's Cheese of the Month, there's Fruit of the Month, and now growing strong, second generation is Wine of the Month.
And this man's very knowledgeable about wine.
Fun.
You're going to learn some things you didn't know, yeah, and have a little bit of fun along the way.
And he's fun too, yeah.
So here's Paul. Hi, folks. Anne wanted me to do this interview, but I had to defer because the first part about it is much too difficult for me. Go ahead, sweetheart.
Yeah, I'm pretty good with Armenian names.
Yeah, you're doing pretty well.
Paul?
That's not an easy one. That's, you know, I've only seen one name longer, so you're doing really well.
Yeah, well, Kalemkiarian.
Yeah, very good.
And it is Armenian, right?
It is,
both
sides.
I had really good friends who are Armenian. That's probably helped. Anyhow.
We do make good friends once in a while.
Yeah. Anyhow, I mean, the reason that you're on this program is you've had a really interesting life and career, started by your father, who inaugurated the original Wine of the Month Club, which is a wonderful concept. And you started in the business at age 16 delivering. Then it was not by mail, I guess, right?
That is correct. It was by truck. And we were in a little town called Palos Verdes Estates in Southern California, which, well, was home to people like Jim Barrett, who owned Chateau Montelena, and Dave Stair from Dry Creek used to hand deliver his wines to my dad's wine shop.
Really?
Okay, so this is how you got started, because your father was in the wine business already.
He was a pharmacist by trade in the 60s. His last pharmacy that he purchased in like 68, 69, he insisted that the guy sell him his liquor store, which was really booze and ice cream. And that was good for me. He decided that he wanted to make it a wine shop, and it became one of the premier wine shops in Southern California. And like I said, it hosted the first wines out of Chateau Montelena vineyards from Jim Barrett. And we actually featured the 1972 Chardonnay with the vintage prior to the big winner. So it got to the point where he was moving from the pharmacy to the liquor store because, well, people that came in the liquor store were happy, and the ones that came in the pharmacy were hurting.
What was the name of the shop?
The wine shop was Palos Verdes Wines and Spirits. And so if you look on our website, you see this black and white picture of myself around 16 or 17 years old. My dad's still in his pharmacy smock because he'd just come over from the pharmacy. And he sort of got tired of walking back and forth, so he decided to start choosing wines for the customers that were coming in and asking for recommendations. He decided he would choose them at the beginning of the month and post them up on a floor stack, and those became the wines of the month. And it just sort of evolved from there.
Well, no, it doesn't predate the Book of the Month, so he had a kind of a business model, the Book of the Month Club, right?
That is correct. The Book of the Month and the Fruit of the Month were probably the few continuity businesses that were out there. However, in this case, it evolves very slowly. People left Palos Verdes, and they would call my father and say, you know what, we moved to here, moved to there. We would love to have you just ship your recommendations every month because we enjoyed them so much.
Uh-huh.
And then on Tuesdays, which is still my day that I taste wines here at Wine of the Month Club, my father would set up, or I would set up for him. I'd go upstairs and set up the tastings, and he would invite the doctors that supported his pharmacies to taste with him.
Uh-huh.
That became the original panel to determine which wines would be selected.
Wow.
Now, it must be hard to do this month after month after month. I mean, how many wines do you taste in a year?
We average about 300 wines a month. I taste on Tuesdays anywhere from 50 to 75. Plus, then we go off-site to many, many tastings. In fact, we're going to Europe in March to taste wines in the Provence.
Oh, so, that's a good area. That's good.
Yeah, we're excited about that. At the end of the, it's very interesting. It is a tough job. I mean, people say, "Ah, that sounds like a really hard job. You get to drink wine for a living." Well, Tuesdays is a pretty good day, I guess. But you know, we if I taste 60 wines on Tuesday, I'm going to tell you that we reject 45 of them.
Yeah, I don't know how you can taste. I mean, we used to be part of a blind wine tasting club. Everybody was pretty sophisticated, and I don't know how after about the sixth sample, I think you get palate fatigue.
Well, my record is 162.
Goodness.
But I will admit, at that point, it was pretty tough. But you get to where you're only taking one sip and you're spitting it out and you know exactly what you're looking for and what it's supposed to taste like for the price. I mean, our real benefit to our business for the consumer is we have tasted everything you see on the shelf. And we know which ones are the better values based on what they're asking.
So your position really is you're delivering value. You're delivering good wine at a price that's more affordable than ordinarily would be.
That's correct. That's exactly right.
So and you do that by squeezing the middle of the distribution process out of it, right?
Well, part of it is our ability to buy, since we buy so much. And the other part is that the way the wine business is, since it's agricultural, the little guys really have no chance of getting into the big wholesalers' books. It's such a controlled industry that these poor guys that start these wineries that make really good wines, just to break into the marketplace, it's like trying to get a toothpaste spot, you know, against Procter & Gamble. It's
right.
Almost impossible. So there's wonderful wines out there. And everybody says, how do you, you know, how does it keep coming? I said, it's unbelievable what comes through here. You should see. the volumes of wines. I have samples. I got hundreds of bottles down there now that I'll never get to.
Well, I think the world divides up into half of the world wants to own a restaurant, and the other half wants to own a vineyard.
You're right. Usually the question is it a surgeon or were they a government contractor? Because those seem to be the two most prolific professions
or a movie star.
When we were in Paso Robles, we had a winemaker from, was it Burgundy?
Bordeaux.
And his wife. We had a hospital administrator from Pittsburgh, and we had a retired NFL football player, each one owning a neighboring vineyard.
What an
vineyard.
Interesting combination.
Yeah.
Any of them making any money?
They're happy. They have parties.
They're doing okay. Two of them made plenty of money.
And the third one must be doing okay.
Yeah.
The old adage, if you want to make a small fortune in the wine business, start with a large one.
Exactly. That's what Peter always says.
It's very difficult.
Now, let's come up to the current situation, because the shipping of wine across...
Could I ask one question? Oh. Before you move on, I want to know if you, Paul, has had any specific wine training. Did you go to
oh, we've done.
Did you have any formal training?
No, we have not done sort of sommelier schools and those things. However, you know, we've been to the Burgundy course and the Bordeaux course and the Alsatian course and the German course.
Oh, you have taken courses.
Yeah, it's a school of hard knocks, I suppose. However, my father has lots of training in the wine business, and so we set out early on when I started working with him. We were split up at a tasting, at a very fancy Bordeaux tasting, and so we didn't get to sit next to each other, and on the way home, we compared notes, and we were on the same page on 85% of the things
really?
We tasted, and we both decided at that point that I was capable of making some of these decisions, so I made some very riskless decisions in the beginning, but really what it comes down to, and again, I suppose that, you know, I know we can sit and chew the fat about wine as well as anybody, however, the big difference, again, and I think you guys, Peter pointed it out, is that we compare values better than anybody. So just because you see Francis Ford Coppola's wine on a shelf for $12.99 as a Cabernet, I can tell you that the Cabernet on the way that's $20 isn't as good, but the one next to it that's $10 might be better.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is the for those people who can't afford to spend all their time in California and other places where they make great wine, going around tasting them themselves, you're a substitute for that. But back to what I was asking you before, one of the issues that you face and that we as a potential wine club subscriber who can't in Pennsylvania, what's the current state of that legislative arena?
Well, it's very dynamic, for one. It changes regularly, and there's actually a wonderful company now that's born of just this problem, so they're making a living at the fact that this is so complicated.
Really?
You know, it's called shipcompliant.com. You want to look at it. They do everything now.
Okay.
And the key is, here at Wine of the Month Club, I'll just tell you how we've solved part of it. We do carry three licenses here. One is we can import and wholesale wines, so we use that in certain states like New York and Massachusetts. We can make wine here. We have a license to manufacture wine. We use that license in various states, and then we're also a retail arm, so we can use the retail license depending on the state. It's very complicated. Just before I called into you folks, my tax in-house tax compliance worker came in, and she showed me that Oregon was not happy with our status and wanted us to put up a bond and was going to suspend our license. They were wrong, but it's all bureaucracy. Here's what I think. Here's my take on it, Peter. I think because it's all post-prohibition Joe Kennedy stuff, I don't mind paying a wholesaler. You know, everybody wants their tax revenue, right? That's what it comes down to. I'm sure Pennsylvania would, if they had a way of controlling it, if people would pay them the tax revenue, they could care less where the wine came from.
You can actually do that, but the problem is that that you have to pay the tax, and you're paying the tax for somebody who's doing nothing at all.
Well, that's true.
Other than collecting a tax.
Yeah, the
you're
big,
right.
The big problem in Pennsylvania, aside from the conservative interior, is the large union behind the staffing of the wine stores.
You have done your homework, because it's all in the wholesalers.
Well, we live
the wholesalers of America have a very strong lobby.
Well, we live here. We're stuck with it, I guess. The last wine club we had fired us. As I told you before, they came on the air. They fired us because they're tired of the shipments coming back.
Yeah, we get letters, you know, constantly from states saying, or FedEx saying, you know, you can't ship here, and we have to prove it over and over to them that we're allowed to ship there, or not there in Pennsylvania, but other states. It's just complicated. And your solution is by far the most logical, which is, you know, why isn't it just an open market and we just ship and buy wines wherever we want? Well, short of that, which will never happen soon, I'd be happy to pay the wholesaler who's pressuring your local legislature to make sure that people like me don't do business there. I'll just pay them. I'll tell you how much I shipped and what I shipped, and I'll send you a check, just like I have to do in many states. Why make me go through all this headache when the result's the same? People end up getting their wine. I just have to go through, for instance, Massachusetts. I have to ship the wine on a truck. It's already packaged. It stops in a wholesaler. It has to sit on his ground for 30 minutes. Does that make any sense?
No.
And then he calls a truck, and that guy picks it up and delivers it to a retailer. The retailer calls FedEx. FedEx picks it up and delivers it because we've already labeled it.
Good grief.
Well, what a waste. Why don't I just ship it direct, and I'll send you your checks?
Well, let's do something constructive. You taste a lot of wines. And what I'm always interested in finding out from someone who's tasting wines is two things. First of all, what should be the price point that people have where they expect to get a reasonable wine at retail? And then how much less than that do they pay if they go through a wine club like yours? So that's one aspect of value. But the second important thing is what are the really interesting wines which are modestly priced? Are there new regions of the country? Are there new producers? So that you can help achieve that sweet spot and be happy with what you have in your glass at dinner time.
So the two great questions. The first being, what can you expect to pay from a club like ours versus walking into your local store and trying to find things? Nothing on the internet, generally, at least that I can tell from the wine world, is pure outright retail. I know a lot of retailers in this city of Los Angeles, for instance, that charge, you know, top shelf retail for their wines. So you're not going in there to get a bargain, you're going in there to get somebody's opinion. And so we offer that opinion at a substantial discount. Generally, if I'm selling a wine for $10, it's going to be on the shelf in the neighborhood of $14 to $15. There are times I featured a wine that was $20 to $25 on the shelf, and I show that often to my customers that we're selling for $9.99. I just featured a wine in an email special to my customers. I showed them that one of the largest retailers in America, it's $14 or $13.99. We sold it for $5.99. Same exact wine, current vintage, on the shelf at their local big box retail. So because of our purchasing power and our ability to keep our margins low the way we operate our business, you're usually saving 20 to 30%. If you want more of anything that we feature, which is guaranteed available for 90 days, it's even larger percentage. I did a wine a few months ago, and I don't just feature, by the way, wines that are $12 and $15. I sold a wine recently that was $49 a bottle. However, I showed my membership that most places on the web, it was more than $90 a bottle.
Yeah. There you go.
So we're literally half
price.
How
do you do this when you have to also pay all the shipping costs? You just told us about shipping into Massachusetts. I mean, that's a lot of extra work.
It is a lot of extra work, and I think that's the benefit of wineofthemonthclub.com versus some of these monolith clubs that are named after newspapers and periodicals, and that is, you know, there's a guy like me sitting here who's managing every penny to make sure that we get the best values we can bring to our customers. It's a privately owned company. As I sit at my desk here, in front of me is my customer service department. Behind me is my fulfillment department. We manage every step of the way. And oddly, or maybe interestingly, my FedEx prices are lower than the Napa Valley Wine Consortium for shipping.
Now, let's go back to the other question, and this is probably the $64,000 question anyway. Where's the sweet spot today in terms of sources of wine, and if you have a particular vintner that you really like? No, we'd certainly be interested in hearing that, too. Everybody's been patiently waiting through 15 minutes of this interview so they can get this real pearl of wisdom from you.
Well, it's, my wife would argue with that I'm a wise guy, but we'll run with that. Right now, the hottest ticket in value is South America.
Mm-hmm.
And Argentine, let's just take Argentine Malbecs. There are some wonderfully complex, interesting wines that are less than $10 from there. And when you compare those to their counterparts from Cahors, those places in France, you know, they're superior in character and quality. And so the value is very high right now. Dollars kind of lost some ground to the euro recently. So the European wines that we're getting in aren't as good as they were 2 years ago for the same price.
Okay.
You can still find the good ones, but they're just not as good. One of the things that I think most people don't understand about the wine business is that only probably 5% of all wine is bottled by the person that grew it. So pretty remote. So that is why there's some great values in branded wines that don't have necessary facilities to make wine. So you can find some of these brands on the shelf that somebody made up. They made up the name, but they find really good juice that's inexpensive, and they bottle and blend really nice wines for the price. And there's a lot of wonderful California Appalachian wines. Well, we just did one from Pat. You remember Pat Paulson?
The name's vaguely familiar.
The comedian from the
60s. Yeah, I was going to say I know. The comedian,
really dry sense of humor. Yeah. There was a campaign in 1968. He was running for president.
Right.
A joke.
Mm-hmm.
Remember?
Yeah.
Well, his son is making his wines again, and we just featured a Bordeaux blend. It's a Merlot Cab, a Malbec blend. It's gorgeous. You know, I think I sell it for $7.99. And it's a Paso Robles Appalachian wine, as you know, does well with Bordeaux varietals.
And what is it called?
It's called Pat Paulson's Reserve Red.
Okay, that's very complicated.
Pretty creative, huh?
So South America, right now you're thinking Europe is a little more expensive because of the currency shifts.
That's correct.
Eastern Europe, is that not hot anymore?
Well, we just did a wine from Romania. And it's a grape called Fatiesca Niagara. I won't say it was inexpensive. It was around, for us, you know, $18 is expensive. But what an opportunity. And that's another benefit that maybe we didn't discuss yet. And that is, would you walk into your local wine shop and see a floor stack of Romanian Fatiesca Niagara and say, well, that sounds like a good one?
No, I wouldn't touch you. But I would say that sounds like bull's blood from Bulgaria.
Yeah, that's right. I agree, Bicaver, right?
And the last time I drank that, I threw up.
Yeah. So we try to avoid that reaction with our customers, but this is wonderful wine. Another interesting varietal that, and oddly European, in that we were able to get a good price on it because no one's heard of it. It's called Mencia, the TH sound, but it's spelled Mencia.
Spanish?
Yeah, Spanish, exactly. And it's from the northwest part of Spain. Very small number of hectares that are grown in this way. Wonderful wine. Excellent wines. You know, you probably wouldn't buy them, right, if you walked into the store. How would you know?
For people to get more information and consider whether this is a good deal for them, Paul, you have a website, correct?
It's wineofthemonthclub.com, and I can add that you never pay for wine that you do not like here. And the reason is, I know I can't please all the palates all the time. Everybody's different. So if there's something that doesn't meet your expectations, we will fix it, and we'll fix it for nothing. And that's just our policy. And even what's that empty bottle guarantee they used to have? There's somebody on radio right now has a face cream that's, even if you have an empty jar, we'll replace it. We'll replace it. You drink the whole bottle and you just don't like it? You just didn't figure it out till the end? Well, we'll replace it for you.
Okay, Paul. I sure wish we could join listeners around the country. You should be very interested in this, I think. Listeners around the world, you should be jealous that you don't have this kind of access where you are. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, and you're delightful, Paul. Thank you.
And also ramming it down our throat, the way you're sitting, it's sunshining, and here it's snowy.
So sorry. Thank you so much. Nice talking with you
folks.
And we'll be back with another fascinating family liquor story right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay.
And here we are again. I think we probably should have synchronized this next interview with Valentine's Day because it's a really, Peter calls it a spirit story, but I call it a love story of a man for a woman, a man for the land, and a man for this very special drink called mezcal. So we're going to be talking to Judah Cooper and his brand mezcal called Mezcal Vago. Well, I think that we need to start right at the basics here, Judah, because there's so much I realized I don't know about mezcal. We're talking to Judah Cooper, who, with his partner, Dylan, you have a long story and a very romantic story, and it's on your website, but why don't you just bring us quickly up to date? Now, you went with your partner to Oaxaca, and what happened?
Well, yeah, if you read that story on the website, you'll see, yeah, exactly. But that was back in the early 90s. And my partner Dylan and I, my business partner, we met actually camping in Telluride, Colorado, in the town park there one summer. We randomly pitched tents next to each other, and we became friends ever since then, spending many years kind of being ski bums and working in the tourist industry in Telluride. And you get these long off seasons between the summer and the winter seasons in those mountain tourist towns. And so we did a trip together to Oaxaca, Mexico, and we spent quite a bit of time in the city and also down on the coast. And so that's where it all started, and that's where we first got a taste of mezcal.
Yeah, now, Oaxaca, I've been there, and it is a really beautiful, beautiful place. And it happens also to be the best growing area for a certain kind of agave, right?
Well, yeah, interestingly enough, so Mexico has more varietals of agave, I think something like 240 types, than any other country in the world.
Yeah,
does grow all over the world, but there's by far more the varietals and types in Oaxaca. And in Mexico, I should say. And in the state of Oaxaca, there's the most variety in Mexico. And in a couple of these towns where we're producing, there's actually more varietals than anywhere else in Oaxaca, and so the most in the world. So
yeah, I was surprised.
We make mezcal from about 35 different types of mezcal.
Okay.
Mezcal from 35 different types of agave, excuse me.
Okay. Should we ask you what the difference is between mezcal and tequila, just to get that cleared away?
Sure. The important thing to know about that is that all agave spirits, all distilled agave spirits, were called mezcal back in the day. Then you have what you call a denomination or appellation of origin, just like we would know that champagne is from a very certain region in France. They made a name called tequila, and they decided that it had to be a certain type of agave and made in a certain region. And so that's where the tequila came from, as far as the legal name and the appellation of origin. As tequila got industrialized, they went away from the traditional processes of making mezcal, which are baking the agave piñas in an earthen oven for several days. They changed that to either baking them or there's a couple different methods, steaming them. And then mezcal we sort of hand grind, either literally with a wooden mallet or with a stone wheel. And some tequila is stone ground like that with a tahona, but others are made using a diffuser where they can actually extract the sugars from the raw agave instead of after the cooking and make their tequila like that. A lot of tequila is pretty heavily filtered, and a lot of good tequila is aged in barrels where there is some aged mezcal, but I would say traditionally and the majority of what's on the market is a Hoven or young mezcal. So those are the main differences.
I wanted to just interject for a second here. Now, you say somebody sort of invented tequila as a subset of mezcal. When did that happen?
You know, I should do more homework on that, so I don't want to say something incorrect on the air, but it's definitely something to look into. I don't know when the exact date of when
okay.
that happened was, but the important thing to know is that tequila really is a mezcal. All agave spirits are mezcal. But now they, of course, have an appellation of origin for mezcal as well, and they can only come from, I think, they might have added a ninth just now, but eight or nine states of Mexico, but by far the majority comes from the state of Oaxaca.
Well, now, your company is called Mezcal Vago, and I guess people should pay attention to that because you're going to hear that more and more and more. You, as I understand it, get your base product from growers. around in the area where your company is located in Oaxaca, right?
We're actually, that's another great difference between tequila and mezcal. Most tequila, actually, you have the industry of distilling the tequila and you have the agriculture industry of growing agave. It's such a young thing business-wise in Oaxaca, mezcal, it's so young as far as being moving towards industrial that it's all family-grown and estate-grown agave for the most part down here. Okay. We source, by far the majority of our agave comes from our family's land. We've been growing it for more generations than can be remembered. But we have quite a bit of it, and we do buy from some relatives and other people in the village. But the agave that we do buy that's not from our family farms is actually just one little plot of land over, so it's the same terroir, the same aspect on the hill, the same sun, the same soil, and all that. So we don't really source from all around. We actually take, by far the majority of what we have is from our family farm or from neighbors or relatives. And the town where our ranch is called Candelaria Yegale, and it's about 3 hours outside of Oaxaca, way up kind of in the middle of nowhere. This is a 200-person town, so we really take pride in being able to buy agave from the surrounding villages, and we can get into it a little later if there's a pending agave crisis, but we take pride in trying to pay more than the going rate for agave, so we can really try and stimulate that little town of 200. There really is no economy there.
Now, the little brochure that you send out, it shows things like burrows with a grinding stone. I mean, do you really work at that level?
And so my father-in-law does, they call it tahona in tequila, but really we don't use that word down here. We use a different word called la molienda. And anyway, so it's a giant cement and rock wheel. And yeah, a mule will run that around in circles and crush the agave. And so my father-in-law uses that. Tio Ray, Uncle Ray, he actually won't even go to that modern technology. He hand mashes this with a wooden mallet. And this is the way, and you know, my father-in-law used to do this when he was much younger, but they've been using the stone wheel for the last, I think, 30 years or something like that. So that's actually modern technology.
But it's not industrialized at all. It's really artisanal.
Well, according to my uncle, that's industrial mezcal that my father-in-law makes because he uses the stone wheel. But, you know, we had to sign a few papers together where my uncle and my father-in-law, their palenques, their little villages are actually 6 hours from each other, so they don't spend a lot of time together. But we were all there signing some paperwork, and they started talking and about maybe upgrading over there, and I had to quickly separate them so we can keep those gems of mezcal the way they are with the hand mashing and everything, because it really does make a difference. And we love having the unique varietals. My father-in-law distills in copper, and my uncle distills in clay, and so their mezcals are very complementary to each other. They're quite different in flavor and character.
Yeah, now we had a sampling of different, sort of like hand-printed on the bottles, the little sample bottles. What are some of the varieties, and how are they different one to the next?
Well, we have one, and by far the majority of mezcal that you'll find, if it's not labeled on the bottle, it's going to be from Agave Espadin.
Interesting to note
is that Agave Espadin is the genetic mother of blue agave, which tequila is made from.
Okay.
It's very easy to cultivate. It's high in sugars. It grows quite large and makes wonderful mezcal. Another one we do is called Elote, Mezcal Vago Elote. And that's actually, you know, my family, they're corn and bean farmers. They're poor farmers from up there, and they live a very sustainable life. They have their animals, and they grow their corn and their beans, and they supplement where they can with work. And so we actually take corn from the family farm, toast that, add it to the already finished Espadin mezcal. So we toast the maíz on a comal, like what you would make tortillas on, and then put it into the finished Espadin mezcal for 4 or 5 days, and then do a third distillation to clean it back out. And so it's all 100% agave alcohol in there, but there's this light toasted sort of tortilla flavor from the corn, and that's the difference between those two. And then we have about 5 or 6 other varietals, and we're constantly doing little special batches and one-offs, and all of those are from different types of agave. We do a one from a Quiche, which is agave Karwinski, a Mexicano. We do a Tobalá, which is one of the more famous and sought-after agave types. And then we do some interesting blends, but we try and stay away from the word blend or mix, because those are real negative connotations in tequila and in the industry in general, which meaning that you might put part agave and part cane sugar, or like a rum type alcohol in there, but we don't do any of that. When we say blend, we call it ensemble, and what we mean is we blend different types of agave, and we do that when they're raw. So by weight, in the beginning, we put maybe Coyote, Espadin, Mexicano, roast those piñas together, grind them together, ferment them together, and distill them together. And those are our ensembles that we do. And we used all different types, Coyote, Arroqueño, Cerrudo, Barril, and many more types. It goes on and on.
Well, you know, how are you going to grow your market when it's all this handwork?
Well, you know, we're not really obsessed with growing our market and making this big business to sell out or anything like that. We truly are committed to staying artisanal, keeping to our roots, and doing the best we can to work with what we've got, and really, really try and make real truth in mezcal, put truth in mezcal, like what the real mezcal you would find in the mountains of Oaxaca is, in the bottle, and share that with the world. We've got a real opportunity here, seemingly, to make a legacy brand, to create a multi-generational brand that stays in the family, and that's our goal. So fortunately, there's a great brand of mezcal that most people who are mezcal lovers will have heard of, Del Maguey Mezcal, done by another guy, Ron Cooper, different Cooper with a C, actually, from me. But he's been at this for about 10 or 15 years at least now, and his method is of marketing his brand is to bring in, not to expand one type of mezcal from one village and blow that up and make it industrial, but to keep bringing different mezcals from different villages. And so, you know, I'm sure we'll follow in Ron's footsteps. They have amazing mezcal, and he's a great guy. And so we'll do that same method where we keep bringing, you know, unique and new mezcals that aren't represented in the market. So when my father-in-law, Aquilino, and my uncle, Tio Ray, when they can't meet demand, we'll bring in another special mezcal from a different village or a different varietal, and hopefully something totally unique to the market.
How do you come to market in the United States, for example, and other countries? This is not the easiest thing in the world. It's not the easiest business in the world to get into.
A lot of people told us we were way behind the curve, and, you know, people will always naysay whatever your business plan is, but we really believed from tasting a lot of, you know, I've been down here and obsessing on mezcal for a number of years now, and I really felt like, well, an interesting thing to note about our mezcals are, they've never been sold or exported before, they've never been bottled commercially, and they also taste quite different from any other mezcal, so I really felt like we offered something unique to the market, and so we really tried to believe in what we were doing. We put tons of heart into it, and we really just tried to stay true to our ideals and our roots, and at the bottom line of it all, to have something great in the bottle. And we were very, very, very lucky to get some wonderful partners. This guy, John Garrett, our distributor from Texas, where we first launched, we got some of the guys like this on our side, and it just has built out from there. So we haven't had to do a lot of, like, really hard marketing. We've wanted to just get our mezcal in the hands of mezcal lovers, of foodies, of people who really care about products coming from a family and having a real backstory, and then bottom line, being great taste, and we wanted to kind of start with the A players like that and let it trickle down organically, and that's really worked for us. And the reason that's worked is because of great partners like John Garrett and a couple of the guys he's brought us to in other states, like Nicholas Palazzi in New York, and guys in Pennsylvania, like in Philly, you got David Suro, just a treasure in the agave world out there, who helped bring us into Philly, where, so he could have us in his restaurant, Tequila's out there.
Now, there's an interesting backstory in here that I've been hinting at, sort of like a love story. You want to conclude with a happy ending kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it was touch and go there for a little bit. I mean, when I met my wife, you know, I felt literally, it wasn't like, I wouldn't say love at first sight, but it was the strangest feeling when I first saw her. I actually had I'm a surfer, so that's what I was doing down in Mexico. I spent about 8 years surfing the Pacific coast of Mexico. I've driven, you know, from California to Peru. I've spent years just looking at every beach and looking for hidden waves and stuff. And after all of that, my favorite place in the world was one little hidden island, actually, near Puerto Escondido. I got an ear infection surfing, which will happen occasionally, and was in great pain. Went into the little rural clinic on this little island, and out walked my wife. It wasn't love at first sight as much as I just knew instantly that this was the mother of my children, and this is the woman I'd be with for the rest of my life. But of course, she did not think that at all, and it took months. And you know, she's She's from a ranch up in the middle of nowhere in Mexico. You know, our worlds are completely different, our backgrounds. And so it was a very interesting courting. I mean, it wasn't anything like used to from the States. I mean, I literally would just go every day after she got off work and, you know, we'd hold hands and walk on the beach. And, I found out she was engaged and, and it seemed hopeless at times, quite hopeless. A couple of nights I drowned my sorrows in Mezcal, furthering my love of Mezcal. But my, my resolve stayed true. And in the end, I won her love and the rest is history. And just out of sheer luck, her dad was making some of the best Mezcal around.
Okay. So he was already making Mezcal.
Yeah. So Aquilino's been making Mezcal for more, from his father and his grandfather and his great-grandfather, and that's as far as they remember, and surely they were making it before that. I mean, we actually just have this new recipe that we found from, actually, Aquilino's great-grandfather, where he made these blends of Tepestate, Cuiche, and Esparin that he was famous for in this little town, Guichá, back in the mid-1800s. This guy's name is Antonio Garcia. So we found his old recipe, and we recreated that. We're actually aging it in these 100-year-old clay storage vessels that are from the family that are called cántaros, and we're bringing that special for one bar. Actually, there's a great bartender called Bobby Hugel has this amazing agave bar called The Pastry War in Houston, Texas, and so this is a special batch for him. So this is a recipe from Aquilino's great-grandfather, from Antonio Garcia, from the mid-1800s, and we'll see how that comes out. That'll be a fun one. More generations they can remember, but never commercially. So. Let me know if you want me to go more into the history of Mezcal and how that all works. But there was a thriving underground market, non-taxed market of Mezcal for years and forever. But when the rise of tequila happened, the boom of tequila, sort of in maybe 15 years ago or so, before that, all the poor people of Mexico, not the rich people, they sort of looked down on Mezcal. But
it's a bit rougher, isn't it? A bit rougher. The Mezcal tastes a bit rougher. It sort of reminded me of grappa.
Actually, that's kind of a misnomer. I mean, certainly you can water back a mezcal to 40% or less, like a tequila, and you could filter it a million times and make it smooth. But, I mean, it's like I don't want my food put in a blender. I've got teeth, and I've got taste buds, and I want something that has complex flavors. But I think the misnomer that mezcal is this rough, harsh stuff. I think that's going by the wayside with some of these elegant mezcals that you have coming out, which are beautiful. But
you're certainly doing your bit for that. Now, Sam, there was some background.
I became kind of addicted to it. By the way, I mean it's a taste that you get used to, and then you miss it. You know what I mean?
It's quite funny. I mean, when I first got into it, I used to like put an ice cube in there and sort of sip it in a cocktail . And then, I totally got used to it. And now I have trouble drinking anything else. I mean, people serve me these things that are supposed to be amazing, and they just taste kind of like half of something, without all that punch. So when I do drink something else, I quite enjoy cask strength, whiskey or those Navy gins or, something that's got a little punch to it.
Let's wrap up by saying, telling people how they're going to get this. Did you ship over website?
Well, yeah, so we're in quite a few states now. So we're in Texas, Colorado, New York, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Washington State, Oregon, California, Kentucky, and New Orleans. So in those places, you should be able to find us in the stores. And then otherwise, online, there's a couple of great stores like Ludwig's Fine Wines in California, K&L Wines out of California, Aster Wine on the East Coast out of New York has us available, Andrew's Wine Cellar in New York as well. And all of those, if you Google those, you'll find right away.
And let's give the name one more. The name is Mezcal Vago, V-A-G-O, which is probably pronounced Vago, right?
That's right. So mezcalvago.com That's a mezcal with a Z.
Great. Right. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
It's a wonderful story. Thank you.
It is.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, you guys. This is a fun little family project, and then any exposure and creating any lovers of our mezcal, it means the world to our family. So thank you so much for that.
Okay. Well, bye for now.
Take care, guys.
Adios.
And that's all we have time for until next week. So until then,
bye-bye.